Hello, welcome to The Addict's Advocate, a podcast geared towards the suffering addict and those in recovery. This podcast does not provide any medical advice. No material on this podcast is intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare professional with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen. And never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you have heard on this podcast. Enjoy the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome again to another episode of The Addict's Advocate. I'm your host, Dusty Dean, and it is my pleasure that I have a good friend with me on the talk tonight. His name is Robert. How are you doing tonight, bud?
Doing well. Good to see you.
Doing good, good, good. Good to see you. I know it's been, I think 6 months now since the last time we saw each other. And I know that a lot of life has been lived, especially for someone that's trying to maintain sobriety and live life in the new reality of no substance use and all its shapes and forms. But, you know, so I typically start off the night, the conversation with just, you know, you giving a little background on yourself.
Yeah. So my name's Robert. Clearly I'm in recovery. I've been in recovery for probably almost 20 years, I should say, somewhere around 20 years. I just turned 40 last year. I just hit 90 days of continuous sobriety. Alcohol was what I chose to use to make myself feel different. Maybe better or worse. It made me feel better at times, made me feel a lot worse at other times. It's been a lot of ups and downs. I did start drinking at a very early age. So we can get really into the nitty gritty, get down into, you know, nature versus nurture. For me, I think it's a combination of both. In my genetics, there's alcoholism that goes back. I want to say at least a few generations. And I think it manifested probably with a vengeance because of the nurture aspect. Growing up in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada mountains in a very, very remote town, it was almost kind of lawless, just kind of left to our own devices. And I started drinking really young with a couple older siblings. And yeah, it just kind of escalated from there. Just by the age of 13, it was mostly just alcohol and marijuana use. By the time I was in high school, I don't want to say a functioning alcoholic by the time I was in high school, but I really did care about doing the right thing and getting good grades up to a point. By the time I was 16, I think that summer that I was going to turn 16, I thought it was like a badge of pride that I managed to get alcohol and drink 7 days in a row. Like that was the coolest thing ever. That's where my mindset was. So, I had heard of AA, but I'm like, I didn't know what an alcoholic was at 16 years old. You know, it's like, my parents had gotten a divorce, so like that just kind of broke the family apart. That changed things a little bit. So I had depression, anxiety. I was always an anxious person. Still am an anxious person. And alcohol is a great way to just, you get that warm feeling. It calms you down. And at first, you know, but then it just makes everything so much worse. Started drinking really young, and it caught up to me. I realized probably it was a problem in my early 20s. And I think shortly after I turned 21, I quit drinking for like a month. And I didn't know AA was really an option. I didn't know if I was really an alcoholic, but I was like, okay, this is a problem. So I stopped drinking for a little over a month. And as soon as I picked back up, it just picked up worse than it left off. And I struggled with like goals and knowing what I wanted to do in life. Other than the drinking thing, I mean, I had a pretty good childhood. Lower middle class. My parents owned a home. I didn't really need, I wouldn't want for anything. I always had food and clothing. And I mean, I was provided my first vehicle when I was 16, you know, stuff like that. So, but I didn't have direction. And things just started compounding. I was expecting, with my girlfriend at the time, we were expecting our first child that was unplanned when I was 20. He was born about a month before I turned 21. And, you know, we're living at our parents' house. I was living at my dad's house. And then I ended up living at a friend's house and no real goals or focus. So it was just kind of just all over the place. And just used alcohol to relax and to like get away from the anxiety and the fear that I felt. And just working really shitty jobs. When I started getting DUIs, I think I was 18 when I got my first DUI before my son was born, because I was almost 21 when he was born. I got my second DUI in 2006. My son was about 4, so I was like 25. And finally, I just decided that, you know, this is a problem. After a couple DUIs, crappy jobs. And I went to the Salvation Army rehab when I was 25. And it's a rough program. So I did that in Chico in 2008. And I did 3 months out of a 6-month program. And I think I was the one guy in that program of 50 or 60 guys that wasn't sent there, you know, through the prison system. Basically, everybody else was kind of reintegrating, coming out of prison. And I actually thought I was going to get stabbed. And that's why I left, because some guy straight out of prison was like, didn't like me. Yeah. We didn't get along. And I left and started to turn things around. Slowly, it took a while. The relationship I had with my son's mother was kind of on and off, and she saw me trying to better myself, and we started from scratch again. And I started going to college and was kind of working these jobs that weren't great jobs, but getting myself through school, and ended up getting a bachelor's degree. Got a job as a park ranger, stayed sober for 7 years, which was a good chunk of time from 25 to 32. And at 32, after graduating from college, moved from California to Texas with the family. At that point, I had a daughter too. And I started drinking again because of the unchecked anxiety. I was unmedicated. I wasn't really doing anything to address the anxiety. I wasn't going to AA meetings. I did go to AA meetings for the first 2 years of my sobriety. And then I just stepped away, stayed sober for 5 years just by focusing on family, work, and school. But I remember the two drinks that I had. I think it was two drinks that I had. That tipped things off was two shots of whiskey I had on a flight from Sacramento to Dallas. I was going out to Dallas on a house hunting trip because I was going to move out there. Had to find a place to live, and just got anxiety about maybe everything. I haven't really thought about it. I don't know if it was just the flying or the move. And didn't drink for about a month after that. We got all set up in Texas, and anxiety kicked in again, and picked up a 6-pack, and from then for there, it just like came back with a vengeance. And within a year, I was arrested. My wife took the kids back to California. I was kind of stuck in Texas for a little while and lost my job. Ended up not getting convicted of the crime. But by then, I mean, no wife and kids, no job. Came back to California at the age of 34. Started over again, and this time I struggled for a long time with the drinking, a long time. I was able to get a job pretty quickly, but that job had me traveling a lot for work with other men and women, mostly men. We would share hotel rooms and drinking whiskey and beer after a long day of work was just kind of par for the course. And I think there's a few moments, you know, where it really struck me of how bad it was getting. A coworker told me this. He took me aside and he said, "Hey, last week when you came to our hotel room before we went to dinner, you drank a fifth of vodka in a half an hour and it didn't even faze you. And then we went out drinking on a weekday." And I was just like, that's just how I am. I don't know. I don't know what to do about it. And not long after that, I went on a pretty bad bender, ended up at Kaiser in Sacramento at the hospital. And I hadn't drank for a few hours. I was drinking really, really hard. It'd been a while. And I was actually staying with my mom at the time. And I asked her to take me to the ER. And I showed up totally lucid. I could walk and talk. And the doctor came in and said, "We checked your blood alcohol levels at a 0.42. We checked it three times because we couldn't believe it. You should be dead right now." Handed me a bottle of Librium and said, "If you take these right now, you'll go into respiratory failure and die. If you don't take them tomorrow morning, you'll have a seizure and die." And that is when it really sunk in that, okay, this is pretty serious. And going to the hospital and getting Librium became pretty routine for the next 5 years because I could not stop drinking. I have been to dozens of hospitals. I continued to stay in the same industry I was in. I worked for multiple different companies. I'd gotten fired or quit from several, not for being drunk on the job, but just being not there, not dependable. And I started, you know, just figuring out that I could drink. And then when I needed to stop, I could go to the ER and get a course of Librium and I'd feel great. I'd stop drinking for a little while, sometimes 2 weeks, sometimes 4 months. And something would happen in my life that I wasn't prepared for. And I would drink. It's just the bottle was just always be there. And once I start drinking, I can't stop until it gets to a point where like my body can't take it anymore, or I realize like I have to do something. I'm stuck in a hotel and I gotta go to work. I can't just not live my life. And yeah, I think just last year in 2023, I did 11 intakes for rehab, 11 different intakes. Some it's the same facility, some at some different facilities. Sometimes I'd leave the next day. Sometimes I'd stick it out for a month. And even the last time that I was in a treatment facility, I drank since then. And it was getting really bad, but I managed to wean myself off. I bought like the least appetizing kind of alcohol I could think of, Michelob Ultra, something I'd never choose to drink. And I would drink anywhere from 3 to maybe 11 of those. Somehow I managed to kind of control it. And even on the days, at one point I had this crazy high tolerance where I could drink so much, but towards the end I'd get pretty messed up off of just 3 or 4 of these Michelob Ultras because my body just couldn't take it. My brain could not take it anymore. And I was going to therapy. I've been going to therapy since May of 2023. And I was telling my therapist about that. And I ran out of other options and I couldn't stop completely. I couldn't just go cold turkey because that could be fatal. And I'm someone that suffers from it's called the kindling effect. At this point, I've been through so many detoxes, whether they're medically assisted or not medically assisted. I've been to that point of suffering or feeling that alcohol withdrawal effect that I have. It's a scientific syndrome called the kindling effect, where if I just drank a 6-pack on a Saturday and a 6-pack on a Sunday, by Monday morning, I'd have extremely severe withdrawal that would have to be medically treated. My brain is just primed to go into that overactive state. I'm not a doctor, but the way the GABA receptors work with the alcohol and the reaction, that rebound that you get from drinking. So that's terrifying. Alcohol withdrawal is a nightmare. I actually have crazy hallucinations. I never had a seizure because I would always be able to feel my body. I mean, you can't predict a seizure, but I could tell when things were going sideways. And there's been times where, yeah, I've just gotten alcohol if I couldn't get to the ER. I've had doctors tell me, I'm glad you got that six pack after work, because if you didn't, you'd be in that Motel 6 up in Ukiah, dead. I'd have to get alcohol just to stop the shaking, the hallucinations, the nightmares, the sleep paralysis that comes along with it.
Wow. Well, the first thing that comes to my mind is it's just a level of bravery that you have in order to, keep, going back to, seeking help and all these different ways, shapes, and forms that you've been. I guess one of my questions I have for you is do you think depression and anxiety that drove the alcohol, or do you think that it was kind of the vulnerability that you just say maybe genetically have to be depressed and anxious, and you couple that with alcohol use and the way the brain's interacting with all those things just makes it a kind of a spiral for you? Which, what do you think it is?
I think I was set up for the perfect storm. The combination of the genetics and just starting at such a young age. The anxiety, the depression. Yeah. I mean, I went to alcohol as an escape to feel better. And I'm not going to lie, it makes you feel better. I mean, that's why people drink. But then it turns around and makes you feel worse. And I've lost a lot from alcohol, especially, I mean, the fact that I could have lost my life, whether it be like liver failure. I mean, I got lucky in that department that I've had all that checked. And so far that looks good. But the amount of benzodiazepines that I've taken, it's fairly likely that, I could suffer from early onset Alzheimer's or dementia, because that's a side effect of that. So the consequences are huge. I'm grateful to be alive. I'm happy to be alive. I'm lucky to be alive. And, the therapy is helping a lot. The anxiety currently is unmedicated. I've had a lot of doctors that have been trying to give me SSRIs. I tried SSRIs last year, and I'm kind of correlating the use of SSRIs with some negative things that happened that they're probably not related, but that's just, I'm weary. It's not totally off the table, but I'm weary. I want to give myself some more time with just therapy, time off the alcohol. I mean, 90 days really isn't that long. I mean, it's great. Once you get 90 days, you get 2 days, you get 1 day, you're kind of in the clear. You should always detox under medical supervision, medical advice, for sure. Because even if you're in the clear for the first few days, the DTs can kick in on day three or day four and take you out. But it's no joke.
And you've tried like anti-anxiety medications and things like that in the past?
I don't want to say I've tried, because I've never really given them a fair shake. Some years ago, probably when I was still back in Texas, I tried Zoloft, I think, and I didn't even stay on it long enough, I think, for it to titrate in the system, build up, and be effective. And then just last year, I tried SSRIs, and again, I think I didn't give them more than 5 days, but there was just so much going on, and I was still drinking on them. It was causing my behavior to be, giving me more anxiety. So I would drink more than I normally would. And maybe there's, some sort of contraindication with drinking alcohol. I think there is. You're not really supposed to drink alcohol on those kind of anti-anxiety pills. So,
yeah. Well, and I know like the SSRIs, I think they're typically an antidepressant, right? That's what they're basically geared towards. But there is also, right, secondary medications that are specifically targeting anxiety. Like, for example, Seroquel. I don't know what your experience has been on them, but I tell you that the antidepressant, yeah, takes a long time to get on it, you know, to start maybe feeling something with it. But I tell you, just removing the anxiety through Seroquel has been a godsend for me. And I'm actually on an extended release now. I just take it like a 200 milligram once a day, and it's an extended release. And I tell you, I sleep soundly. I'm present. I mean, all those things that used to be there are just basically gone. I don't even like seasonality, because the season's like Christmas time, this time of year, because it's anniversaries of my father passing. You know, all these times of the year, you know, would definitely like affect me, you know, give me seasonal affective disorder in a sense. And they're gone. You know, it's gone. I'm present. I'm looking forward to the future. I'm not ruminating on the past anymore. So, I mean, I've personally have become an advocate for that, you know, and I think that, you know, anybody that can go and get seek, you know, detox help, right? You should definitely look at the mental health aspect as to why they were drinking or using to that extent anyway, right?
Absolutely. And I haven't tried a lot of those pharmaceuticals that are recommended. I was basically on a cocktail of drugs in treatment. Didn't really like any of them. I tried Seroquel and I tried a number of other things. And I always just tried to go with, just give me the benzos, get me off of the need to have alcohol or benzos. And it's funny because, you know, they give you benzos to get off alcohol. Those are the only two drugs that the withdrawal will kill you. Absolutely fatal. I've never come off of heroin or opiates. I have seen people do it. It looks like something I'd never wanted to do. It looks horrible and painful. I'm not discounting the discomfort, but chances are it's not going to kill you. Alcohol and benzo detox can and will. And I almost died by not seeking help and seeking treatment. This happened last year. I scored some benzos off the street because I wanted to stop drinking. And I couldn't go to the ER anymore. I'd been to so many different ERs so many times that the doctors can look that up. They can see every hospital you've been to and every time it's been prescribed. And then I've had some say, well, we can see this. We're a little hesitant to give it to you, but I will. And sometimes they'd flat out say no. And the local hospital where I live now said no. Go to inpatient treatment. So I scored some Xanax off the street and tried to use that to get off of alcohol. And it actually worked. And I wasn't taking a super high dose of Xanax at all. And I was kind of in the clear, but I had a few meetings that were giving me anxiety and I had a little bit of Xanax left over. So what I ended up doing was taking those for about 10 days and it was still a really small dose. And then I ran out and I got kicked into withdrawal from the Xanax that was just as bad or worse than the alcohol withdrawal. But the effects don't work in reverse. Alcohol does not work to get you off of benzos. I tried and I ended up in the ER again. And they did at that point give me Librium, which is the what's typically used to get off of alcohol. And I mean, even after that experience, I still drank again. It's the insanity of it, of all that I've been through, all these hospital visits. I couldn't not go get a bottle for whatever reason. It's complete insanity.
Do you feel like this time around is different? The 90 days so far?
I do. I haven't had a lot of cravings. I haven't really had a desire to drink. I've been barely aware of the fact that, I mean, at this point, I don't know how alcohol would affect me. But I know that if I started drinking, it would just mean another trip to the ER. It would be another 30 days that I don't want to go through. I'm pretty content, pretty happy. I'm not going to lie. I'm bored sometimes. Sometimes, you know, like this event would be more fun if I had alcohol, or this, whatever I'm doing hanging around the house would be more fun if I had alcohol. I don't think it's uncommon for people that drink to think that they're funnier when they drink. They're more fun to be around when they drink. I was just had more fun because I know I was probably an absolute pain in the ass to people that were around me when I was drunk.
Well, I mean, you obviously have hobbies, right? I mean, one of the things that I wanted to remind you of was, I mean, when I first heard some of the things that you had written, I was utterly impressed. I mean, you have almost a poetic writing style. I think you're very deep in your writing, and I think that you, with the struggles that you've talked about, and just the things that I've heard from you in the past, that you have the ability to articulate those things that some people feel but don't know necessarily how to translate, you know, to a written word. And I think that, you know, at the very least, right? I mean, if you get bored, man, you should write, because I think some of your writings are absolutely beautiful. Something I think that you can share with the world. I really do. And I think a lot of us, you know, when we were together and, you know, in the past, that, you know, there were even other people that remarked upon, wow, I mean, it's pretty amazing. You know, the things that you were putting together and the way that you were, you're creating a visual picture of some of the pain that you've experienced, and your experiences. So that's definitely my recommendation. If I can give you any recommendation whatsoever, I think that your writing is something you should always do, man, because I think that you've got an ability there, a knack for that.
So I appreciate that. Writing's always come easy to me. When I was in when I was five in kindergarten, I could immediately read as soon as I started school, and they just bumped me up a grade. And I was writing in high school, you know, papers that the teacher would pull out and be like, this is amazing. But I'm pretty hard on myself, kind of a perfectionist, and I'm not creative. I'd love to write a novel or something, but it would never be good enough for me, and it probably wouldn't be good anyways. but I'm not creative. Both, I have two older sisters, and they can write and do art. They can draw and paint. I can't play music. I can't draw. I'm not artistic. I'm kind of analytical, but I'm not even good at math. So, but I do appreciate that. I do remember writing that, and the goal was to make it as contrived as possible, just because I kind of wanted to fuck with those people that were there. They were great. They were wonderful. But I was, when I'm in rehab, I don't always embrace everything as much as I should, and I kind of rebel against the rules and the structure. But I love everybody that was at that facility. I really do. I think, as I've been to a lot of rehabs over the years, and I've seen the good ones, I've seen the bad ones, I've seen the good people, I've seen the bad people. And I generally follow the rules, and I try to be cordial and nice to everybody and help the people that need help. Just be there to be someone to talk to, someone to listen and whatnot. But yeah, I get a little bit snooty, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, I think one of the things that, you know, it's a blessing and a curse, is that I think people that are dealing with depression and anxiety, you know, vulnerable types, they can experience a range of emotions that's greater in depth on both sides of the spectrum, right, than maybe a normal person does, right? But I think that, you know, that whereas it can be a curse, right, because you want to, we all want to feel good, right? We want to feel better. We want to feel okay in our day and not, you know, being what feels like a pit of hell, right, with no way out other than substance abuse, right? But, you know, I think there's an increased empathy that goes along with having those emotions. And I think, you know, finding ways to articulate those things, you know, those emotions, I think is important. Because people will respond to you, you know, I believe people, because they can sense the pain, right, in your own writing, right? So what are you doing? I mean, when you get yourself into the funk, what are you doing to get yourself out of it? If you're not turning into a bottle, you're not turning into substance use, how are you? Because I know you have a motorcycle, right?
Yeah, I've got two now. I just bought another one a couple weeks ago.
Okay.
So, but unfortunately, it's still pretty cold. Yeah. At least it's staying light later. So I've been able to take the new one out for a couple little spins, but that is something that I absolutely do. To kind of just, it's a mix of just the freedom, adrenaline, being cool. I mean, having a Harley's cool. because it's a Harley. And then the new bike I got, it's a Supermoto. It's a Suzuki. It's basically a dirt bike with street bike tires on it. So nice. It's fun. And having a hobby is something to do. And just to get you, if I'm starting to feel like that itch, like I got to get out of the house, I got to do something. That's one way to do it, or one thing that I like to do. But no, I can't wait for spring and for summer, because I do spend a lot of time just kind of moping, not drinking, but I just watched YouTube videos. I mean, I got a guitar behind me, but I never really pick it up and play. I've never been able to play guitar well anyways. I can, play a couple little tunes, but I'm looking forward to spring.
Have you been trying to maintain that sober community, keeping in contact with people?
And I've got nothing against AA. I love AA. I haven't been going to a lot of meetings in person. There's an alumni meeting that I try to get to every week. And I have another online sober support group. I'm in a club for men. It's a historical society. There's a bunch of different chapters all over the West Coast, mostly California, but also Oregon, Washington, Nevada, Colorado, Idaho. And these guys, a lot of them I've never even met in person. We've been talking on a daily basis, just on a Facebook group, for a couple of years. And just having that outlet, or being that person that can respond to somebody else that's going through something hard, having that community, that fellowship, I think it's crucial. It really helps. The kind of ironic part is this I call it a club that I'm in, is more or less a drinking club. Alcohol is just part of the thing that they do when we get together in person. I was just at a regional event yesterday, and I didn't even realize. I kind of went to one corner. It was indoor, outdoor at a fairgrounds. I was at an outdoor area talking to a guy who's actually sober, and we were chatting it up a little bit. And I'm kind of looked around, I'm like, why are all these people standing? Why are all these guys standing over here in this corner? I realized we were right next to the line for the beer truck. That's where I would have been first. The first place I would have found normally. And I was standing next to it for 15 minutes. Didn't even know that's where everyone's lining up to go fill up their cups for beer. And there's so much support within this group. I was at a different event, same group in San Francisco back in January. And these guys know whether they're drinking or not. There's multiple Facebook groups, pretty active in the organization. And they're like, you're looking good. How you doing? You look great. Good to see you. One guy kind of pulled me to the side though. And he's like, I didn't recognize him because his face, but I've never met him in person. His Facebook picture isn't his face. It's just, but he pulled me aside and he's like, dude, do you like rehab more than being sober? Cause how many times did you go to rehab last year? And I'm like, dude, I don't know. Why are you giving me a hard time? But he's like, dude, I think you like rehab. I'm like, I hate rehab. But no, he was just kind of busting my balls a little bit, but out of care, definitely came from an area of concern. And he straight up told me, he's like, dude, let me know what I can do. He splits half his time between Santa Cruz and then a town up outside of Plumas County. He's like, you can come crash at my place as long as you need to, if you got to ever get your head together, and I get, offers of support like that all the time, but I want to try to be self-sufficient. I'm 40. I got a 2-bedroom apartment. I got 50-50 custody of my daughter. That's something that was an issue last year that I made it through, even despite all the drinking and rehab trips. And that was one of the causes of one of my relapses, was something didn't go my way, during a fight for custody. And this is something that men and women have to face. There's always going to be challenges and curveballs and things you don't expect. And last March, I had 4 months sober last March, which is what I'll have this coming up March. I'll have 4 months. And I didn't get my way. I saw something kind of came out of nowhere that was a major deal. And within minutes, I was drinking with the intent of oblivion. I knew exactly where it was going to take me, and I didn't fucking care. I went and got a bottle and just started pounding it. And I was aware of what was going to happen. Within 5 days, I was on a flight to Denver to go to a rehab. I wanted to get out of the state. Flew out to Denver, and then immediately 6 days later, I'm like, okay, I'm good. I'm going to go back home. No. A couple days after that, I was in a car on the way to San Jose.
You know, obviously the people that don't struggle don't understand it, right? And, you know, and if they only understood what happens between our ears, right, that causes us to jump in and out of these things and just in a desperate attempt to try to seek help, I think they would be a little bit more empathetic. And I hear what you're saying about, you know, sometimes these meetings and the structures of the meetings. And I think it was one of the provocations for me to try to create something different. I recognized with just being in the inpatient that I was in, as well as in my IOP, that, you know, there's a lot of great people that just want to have real raw conversations, don't want to be put on a timeline for having to accomplish X, Y, and Z goal in a certain period of time, or get past, you know, a level, if you will, to move on to the next bigger thing in your life, right? Because sobriety is a day-to-day struggle. And so I think just the ability to have a community that just, you know, is willing just to, you know, share the horrors of it, you know, share the triumphs of abstaining, and just, you know, just a place to vent, I think is highly important. And that was the hope, was that this podcast was going to create a catalyst for people that if they were struggling, just to listen to others who, you know, maybe aren't too far off in their own, you know, in their problems as the people listening are, you know, and there might be a common thread there. Is there, whenever you've slipped in the past, was there something that you remembered about your sobriety as to, outside of obviously the physical consequences of substance use, and the mental health, weren't there gems that was like carrying you forward to get you back to sobriety again, that you really, you know, that was profound for you?
Oh, I don't know about profound. It's a really good question. I could spend some time ruminating on that. I mean, a lot of it's just basic survival instinct, right, and just, you know, needing to stay alive, needing to, you know, have employment, wanting to be a good person, wanting to lead a full, successful life and leave some sort of legacy, you know, like, hopefully my kid's life will be better than mine. I mean, again, I'm 40, living in an apartment. I've got no equity. And a lot of that's like due to my drinking. But I look back at just the times I've gotten lucky, you know, like some of the really bad consequences of alcoholism have in turn ultimately led to a better opportunity. I don't know how that works. You know, it's just stuff you can't predict, you know. But yeah, it doesn't take long, you know, after a relapse. My relapses are very short. And I started kind of doing the going to the hospital thing really frequently in 2018, 2019, 2020. I was going to the hospital a lot. 2021 was when I started kind of rehab hopping. And I found a center down in Southern California. I've flown down there 5 times, I think. And I would fly down there and I would have my girlfriend at the time drive down to LA to pick me up, because I didn't want to fly back because I thought that would be a trigger being in an airport or just being on an airplane, you know? So, but yeah, no, it would be get sober for 3 to 4 months and then drink for a week or less. Just drink. And then like, I got to go back to rehab or go to the hospital because I didn't want to drink. I hated it.
Yeah. So you're doing everything as far as medication. You're on, not on anything right now, huh? Just purely doing Nothing. Just talk therapy.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel just, I mean, to be honest with you, I mean, I feel like I'd be probably white knuckling it right now if I wasn't medicated. I know that for a fact, just because of my own personal mental health. The depression, the anxiety, and even, you know, potentially, you know, racing thoughts, you know, symptoms of bipolar. Mm-hmm. I know that I would probably be in a really bad place, and I'd probably be sneaking something right now. So, you know, and that's, I guess, one of the blessings for me personally. And when I was in, when I was in treatment, they were willing to kind of just, I was able to tweak and modify everything that I was doing, you know, in a safe environment, just to try to find that combination was going to let me go, okay, I can breathe again and live life and not mentally feel a certain way and or not chomping at the bit to get to, you know, a substance to use to feel better. Right. So I hope, buddy, that you continue, you know, looking at those options, right? Play with them all. I mean, I use Lexapro, and I definitely don't feel like, you know, I've got any depression episodes anymore. I knew that it wasn't killing the anxiety for me, you know, and or like racing thoughts that I was getting, you know, the inability to calm down mentally, right, if you will. And that's where I think Seroquel really, you know, finished it off for me. And, you know, my consequences that I've gained, you know, a substantial amount of weight since I've been on it. I mean, but I'm dieting again. I'm working out a lot, you know, and I'm trying to find those things that I used to do that, you know, made me happy in life. And so far I feel like it's been a success. So I wish that success for you too, bud. I really do. If you came across someone and you had, you know, they came to you and they said, hey, I think I got a problem, I feel, I'm only really drinking on the weekends, but I'm drinking a ton to get blacked out. But I'm really doing it in party surroundings. I'm just going and going and going, and I don't understand why I do it. And now I'm just finding that, you know, my mood during the week is affected, you know, especially Mondays and Tuesdays, I'm hungover as all get out. And by Thursday, I'm looking forward to Friday night. And I think I maybe have a problem. You know, what would you say to somebody like that, that came into your life?
Go to an AA meeting.
Yeah.
Go to a meeting. I mean, I know people that are really adverse to AA, and I don't even go on a regular basis myself, but I think it has one of the best, biggest influences, one of the biggest drivers in recovery. It's not perfect. I was in it and then I dropped out, and maybe I relapsed because I dropped out. Maybe I didn't. I don't know. But the recovery industry, I don't even know if you could call it that. I mean, AA doesn't make any money. They're not a for-profit organization. And I think their principles make sense. But there's no real way. I mean, people have done studies, but I don't know how you can get an accurate number of success rates. The numbers don't look good, no matter however you look at it for addicts. The numbers look bad, basically, every way you look at it. But I think if you're not in a medical emergency and you can get your ass down to a meeting, go to a meeting. Maybe one thing one person says will resonate enough that you'll just go back to another meeting. And I'm not one of the, you know, people that thinks that like AA is a cult, but I don't love AA as much as some people do. There's some people that absolutely love it, but it's life or death, you know, for a lot of us. If alcohol is causing problems, it'll probably only get worse. If you can rein it in on your own and slow down or moderate, then all the power to you. But yeah, if you have to get into like an inpatient, get into an inpatient. I've had friends that have been struggling. The first thing that I ask is, what kind of insurance do you have? I'll make some phone calls right now. And it's unfortunate that, you know, some folks don't have insurance or they're underinsured, and there are facilities available for those people, but they're not adequate. I've done Salvation Army rehab 4 times. I did it the first time and I stayed sober for 8 years. Maybe it's just because I was scared and it was so unpleasant. I didn't want to go back to a place like that, but right. I did the one in Sacramento and I didn't stay for the entire 6 months, but those places are available. They can be helpful. I wish that they had a different approach, and I wish that better treatment options were made more widely available.
Does Yeah, you know, and I agree with you just as far as, you know, the one thing resonating. You know, I still find that when I do go to my meetings here, that as much as I haven't participated in any of the steps, nor have I found myself a sponsor, there are things that are said in every meeting that I sit there and I go, yes, 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 I get that. I feel that. I know that. And I think that, that is, yeah, because it's an easy thing to do, right? Jumping into an AA meeting, right? Because they're all over the place. An NA meeting as well, right? They're all over the place, yeah, all the time, right? And somebody might find something that gives them some hope, right? Because I think that's what I'm trying to do here, right? And I think that's what they're all trying to do is create some sort of hope, some sort of, you know, faith that, you know, things can get better. Things do look better, you know, when you are sober. Has your family responded to you at all positively? Like even like your kid, I mean, do they notice the changes in you when you're not? When you're not, you know, actively in addiction?
Yeah. You know, my family was they've always been supportive. They never really looked into it. I mean, hindsight's 20/20. I wish I could go back now and either tell myself to stop drinking when I was 15 or, you know, tell my parents to tell me to stop drinking when I was 15. Like, I had a keg at my 16th birthday party in my backyard at my dad's house. And I'm not trying to throw my dad under the bus, but maybe I shouldn't have been allowed to have a keg there. Because I was probably already exhibiting signs of alcoholic behavior, and yeah, intervention might have been good. But, you know, again, like I said, just things that have happened because, you know, my drinking that still led to like silver linings, the things that led to better outcomes. But no, I mean, after I got sober and, you know, went to State University and got a degree and became a park ranger, my parents were proud of me. And, you know, they were probably pretty worried about me when I was a teenager and when I was in my early 20s, because I was going nowhere. But I never had an intervention. There was never any discussion about that. I think it should be talked about. The stigma should be removed. And we've worked, not me or we, but, you know, just as a society, I think we've made some strides in that regard, as far as, maybe the way the medical community approaches it, or the way some employers do. I'm lucky to have a wonderful employer right now, not only for the great insurance, but there's just other venues, EAP programs, other groups within the company where we can come together and you can talk. And not everybody is afforded that, unfortunately, right, to have, you know, access to things that I have access to. I wish it was different.
Unfortunately, right? It's typically the addict gets to the rock bottom and ends up maybe getting arrested, right? And there's that form of rehab, which really isn't a rehab, right? I hear what you're saying, and I think that accessibility to those that are suffering, that want help, need help, but don't really know of a way to get it, needs to be available. Good point. Wow, we've covered a lot, bud. I'm looking here at my notes and what I was planning on talking to you about, and I feel like we've covered it. Do you have any gems of wisdom that you want to share on your journey? I mean, obviously you've been up and down this path, you know, quite a few times. It's still, you know, it's still a forward movement, as much as, you know, you've struggled and have relapsed. And I think, you know, one thing's for sure is that once you get into recovery, right, and you do relapse, right, you can't no longer, you know, it's not like you don't know what's behind the curtain, right? You've been there, yeah, you've done that, you know what it's like. And so I think there's an innate knowledge then that you then have to also battle with yourself on, right? And I think that's maybe why your relapses have been so short-lived, right? Because you're just like, I want to stop doing this. Give me help now, right? That's the way that I was. I had gotten to the point where, because I quit, you know, one substance, you know, twice, you know, two separate times, right, for 6-7 years, right? But I felt like I got the cockiness back, right? Like I can handle this. I'm stronger than the substance. I can do it in moderation, blah, 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 blah. And it's a crock, right? And And, you know, one of the things that's been insightful for me is, I don't know if you've ever had a chance to see it on YouTube, but there's a doctor called Dr. Nicole Labor, and she has a topic, basically Addiction 101. It's like a 50-minute long conversation. She's in recovery herself, but she is a doctor, and she provides a fascinating overview of addiction and what it means to the brain and why it's classified as a disease. And so, you know, I go to things like that. I go to like some more of the scientific thing, right? Instead of trying to put the shame and the guilt on myself for not being strong enough to control, you know, my addiction and so on and so forth. That's one of the things that I definitely do as far as, you know, gems of wisdom I like to share. And I also like to share, tell people that, you know, there are so many people out there that want to help you, right? Especially those that are in the know, that, you know, that know what it feels like to be in addiction. You know, they're on your same team. They are rooting for you in your success, and know that you maintain sobriety for long enough, you'll realize that, you know, life can be better, right? Without that monkey on your back in the same way as it was. So anything that you like to share as far as parting thoughts?
There's one that it's just a saying from NA, and I don't even go to NA meetings, that kind of always stuck out. And I think it goes something like, your disease is not your fault, but your recovery, is on you. I totally said it wrong, but your recovery, is up to you, you know? So yeah. It's not your fault that, you know, you have a disease, but it's up to you to do something about it. And
right,
it can be done. You know, life is better sober without drugs and alcohol. If you're an addict, I mean, if you're a normie, then you're probably not watching this or listening to this, but you might know someone, you know, that is. So, help them reach out. You know, there's so many different books. It doesn't have to be AA or NA or the sober faction of the Satanic Temple or, you know, whatever. There's a million different sober groups and sober support groups and literature and help out there. So if you want to stop, it can be done, but it's your responsibility. Maybe that's the word that I was looking for when I said that. Your recovery is your responsibility.
I totally agree, right? I think it's just as much as, you know, somebody with diabetes, right, wouldn't neglect not taking their insulin, right, or, you know, would eat horribly, right, when they know that they have to eat a certain way, right? And you have to take care of yourself, right? I think that's important. So, Robert, this has been good, bud. And I appreciate your time. And I'm wishing you continued success, okay? And you know I'm just a phone call away. If you ever have a bad day, and likewise, I will always reach out to you whenever I'm feeling like I need some help, okay?
Absolutely. Good to talk to you. Good to see you. Thanks for having me on, brother.
Thank you, man. Take care, okay?
Yeah, you too. Peace.
Bye.